This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's sadly pretty much the same litany of issues affecting our environment in Malaysia year after year. We've got the haze, deforestation and the loss of wildlife, among others. I'm joined now by Dr. Sundri Ramakrishna, the Conservation Director at WWF Malaysia, as well as Professor Dr. Ahmad Ismail, the Vice President of the Malaysian Nature Society and a wildlife and ecotoxicology expert, for a look back at the issues that affected our Malaysian environment in 2015. So I think 2015 will probably be remembered as the year of the haze. We were engulfed for months in polluted air caused by forest fires in Indonesia. Could you both just kind of remind us what were the causes of these fires?
I think particularly this year, 2015, it was quite a drought year, prolonged drought, dry season. And on top of it, we had the El Nino. So combination of this had made what we call our peat swamps or peat lands, which is by large found mostly in Indonesia and Malaysia. And Borneo Island has a substantial amount of peat, especially Kalimantan. So it could be accidental fires. It could be a campfire. It could be a cigarette butt. But it also could be intentional clearing of forests for the next agriculture season. But the important part is peatlands contain a lot of carbon. It's inflammable. You don't see it on top. It's actually 3-4 meters down, it is burning. What you see is the dense smoke that comes out and affects wildlife. And I think in 1998, we had a similar severe haze in Malaysia. It's a pity it happened in Kalimantan, but it's also happening in Malaysia.
The haze, as you say, had many negative impacts, including on people's health, the economy, the tourism industry. But Professor, what impact did it have on wildlife in Malaysia?
We don't have a proper observation on our wildlife in Malaysia. But if we look at the anyone in zoo, for example, I visited zoo during that period of haze, and I can see the animals are less active compared to normal. So we need to do a detailed study, because theoretically, of course, we can see the effect of haze on the eyes, on the respiratory system, and what are the long effect of haze problem. Because in the haze, number one, we will see the size of particles. The particle size less than 2.5, for example, it can go to the system. And another one is a toxic chemical that they produce from this haze. We don't really measure what are the chemicals that produce from there. Because, say, for example, the organic carbon that produced by this haze, the forest fire, we don't measure in particular. So in terms of toxicology, we need to have a proper study, because we need data, we need to tell people. So in general, of course, those who understand this, they will say forest fire, haze issues will affect the wildlife, the respiration, the toxicity of the chemicals in the system. But how to tell the public if we don't have the evidence? So this is the issue that not 100% people are talking about the same wavelength with those who love animals.
Yeah, to add to that, actually, basically all the mammals, I mean, mostly those who are arboreal or on treetops, because the trees are being burnt.
Yes.
And those who are below, who are walking on the ground, they are mammals just like us. We have got lungs to breathe. They also have breathing problems. And we heard from some of the rescue centers.
In general, we can say they have a lung and breathing problem. Yeah. But they are very complex in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, say, for example, simple observation is when we have the haze problem, we can see the reduce of light. And then the reduce of light causes productivity for the plant, for example, and product photosynthesis. And then from there, we can see the effect on the insects, the effects on the worms, the effects on the temperature, the microclimates of the forest. This whole system will be affected by the haze. It's not just a health problem, lung problem, respiration problem.
You're absolutely right, Professor. Especially the bees, birds, bats, butterflies, those important agents of pollination, they're unable to see the plant. It's so hazy. They're unable to go to the stigma and pollinate and transfer the pollen grains to another neighboring plant.
Yes.
So, and these are the most important crops for agriculture. These birds, bees, bats, butterflies.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're the one who spread the seeds.
Also.
Yeah. Very important.
Mm-hmm.
True. We're drawing parallels from what happened in many countries. We haven't done an in-depth study. And also the haze affects fireflies. Fireflies are very ecotourism icons in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
They can't find their mate because it's too dense. Mm. And then there's also all these particles, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide.
When it rains... And nobody look at the migratory shorebird.
Yeah, that's true. It'll cause acid rain.
Yeah.
So it's a whole chain of reactions, But the Malaysian government and the universities would need to actually do an in-depth study on this so that we have facts to tell the public and so that governments will actually know that if we do this, this is what's going to happen and therefore mitigate it by ensuring minimize forest fires.
I think there are some agencies are taking it. Step forward to do this collaboration between Indonesia and Malaysia on the scientific side so that we can discuss what's happening. I just went to Pekanbaru recently and our consulate in Pekanbaru, Malaysian consulate also talking about that. So meaning that someone has taken some steps. What we need, more people and aware of this, and then we do a research. We need data as soon as possible so that we can tell the public. And at the same time, we can bring people from all over the world to help this number one or top biodiversity country in the world.
But the one advantage of the haze was it heightened the awareness of people that the environment is so important. We need to look after the environment. You can't say clean air is a giver. It's no more a giver. Mm-hmm. You have to actually look after your environment so that you have clean air. Mm-hmm. So it does spur a lot of thinking and choices for people to choose. Okay, let me buy products that do not come from the forest fire plantations, which are actually producing the forest fire. Let's buy consumer goods from clean, companies.
Moving on from the haze, deforestation is also a major concern with the country still rapidly developing. But Malaysia had the world's highest rate of forest loss between 2000 and 2012, according to a global forest map developed in partnership with Google. Is this something we should be worried about?
Yeah, in fact, Monga Bay is also reported in the last 12 years between the year 2000 and 2012, estimation of 14.4% loss in our forests. I think in some of the states, what is happening is they need the revenue and they're looking at conversion of land to industrial tree plantations like acacia, monocultures and timber latex cone. It is worrying because if it's happening in permanent forest reserves, then the kind of enforcement and policing needs to step up, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we know forest is a sink, right? It has got carbon in the trees, in the soil. And once you cut it, you're going to let it go. So you're actually increasing your greenhouse gases. But it's quite complex, But we advocate for permanent forest reserves and protected areas to be locked up and have your monoculture in lands which are semi-degraded or you do not, where it's not like, should I say, not locked up as permanent forest reserves.
How can we balance the need for growth while minimizing environmental and social impact?
No, we are talking about the loss of forest just now. Our protected forest become reduced from year to year. I think the government are aware about this, but what we need to have more pressure from NGO and public. Why we need to have more forests? What are the important forests to us? See, when we talk about how many acres or hectares of land or protected forest promised by the government to keep the wildlife like tiger and so on, so actually how much left? So this is what we need to declare every year, and in every state, because the problem of the forest is belong to the state, so every state must declare this so that the public NGO know and aware of this reduction of the forest, and all the development you must take a consideration of this forest in Malaysia.
Could I come with some constructive suggestions? Forest and land belongs to the state. Now, the federal government has ratified, become an obligatory to many multilateral environment agreements, like the Convention on Biological Diversity and the UNFCCC Kyoto Protocol. If you want them to protect those forests, then you need to give them incentives to maybe light industries or go into the service sector, so that we don't heavily depend on natural resources. The forests themselves have so much services and goods that it provides, which you can't see. It cleans the water. It's a watershed. It provides a microclimate. Imagine if you live in apartments without trees, an apartment with trees. You see how cool it is. So immediately there is this effect. And we need to look at that relationship and the benefits from state and federal. That's very vital. There's some mechanisms that are being done now, but I think certain states feel that we have less forest than other states. So can you give us some incentives to keep them as forest reserves? But the complexity even increases. The FAO definition of a forest is any tree that is standing, including natural forests and planted forests. Malaysia, according to, I think, the Minister from Environment, when he gave a speech at the COP recently in Paris, he said the forest cover in Malaysia to date is 54.5%. That really includes natural forests and timber latex clone and industrial tree plantations, which are monocultures. If we were to take that mix out of the 54.5%, it will be less than 50%. The government has pledged to keep 50% of its land as forest cover. And so we as NGOs say, let's keep the naturalness intact.
What can we be doing to improve the management of production forests for the supply of sustainable timber?
I think there are technologies and methodologies. Sustainable forest management means there is this legality and we know how the logs are taken out and how the management of the forest, they have a management plan approved by the state. And they have licensed operators given permits to go in and concessions. And I think even the bid for concessions should be more transparent and open. So public know why this company has got 3-5 acres, that has got 10 acres. So on what basis were they done? But there's a few techniques for sustainable forest management, like the reduced impact logging, where you use heavy cranes, you don't go in and do clear cutting. You do selective logging, picking only the choice trees that you can take out, leaving trees which have seeds, they're produced, you know, there's a mother plant. And I think in many of the forest reserves now, they were using these techniques, but still, there is still encroachment, and the transparency of how these licenses are given, how the operators manage, it still can be improved further.
I think the government has to review the forest, you know, the logging forest, how many types of forest they have. They have to review again back, because the current situation may be not suitable for what they passed in the regulation. I mean, for the old system. Because when they want to cut the tree, because we don't want to depend too much on the forest and timber, you know. For timber, there are so many products for the forest that we need or we can benefit of it.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Sundri Ramakrishna, Conservation Director of WWF Malaysia, and over the phone with Professor Dr. Ahmad Ismail, Vice President of the Malaysian Nature Society and a wildlife and ecotoxicology expert. We are looking at a roundup of the environmental stories here in our country in 2015. We've been talking about haze and deforestation. Up next, we find out more about how forest loss affects our wildlife and wildlife loss. You are listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Sundri Ramakrishna, Conservation Director from WWF Malaysia. And over the phone, I have Professor Dr. Ahmad Ismail, Vice President of the Malaysian Nature Society and a wildlife and ecotoxicology expert. Together, we are looking at a roundup of environmental stories from 2015. Now, I understand that most of Malaysia's forest loss occurred in its densest forests, those with tree cover exceeding 50%, which generally, of course, store the most carbon, they're richest with wildlife. How does this affect the wildlife who live in those places?
When there is forest loss, what would happen is those herbivorous animals that depend on the fruits and flowers of this would also not have enough food. And they would then be susceptible to be eaten by other bigger carnivores. So you're going to lose one species or one whole taxa of animals. When you say it affects the distribution of wildlife, but I don't think we have really done scientific studies. To get permits into dense forests, to go in itself and to get permit to do this kind of study, you need to have permission. And you need to know why you're doing this. I don't think Malaysia has done such a study. Because to really to find out how many tigers do we have, how many clouded leopard do we have, it is time-consuming, camera traps, you need a lot of people on the ground, and it takes time to get these results. So we have little pockets of work. For example, WWF concentrates in the Belum Temenggor area, which is the area which has got quite a good number of tigers. And the Wildlife Conservation Society does it in Johor and Indah Rompin. I think what will happen is if you've lost a forest, you're going to have mudflats, rainfall, and the whole ecosystem will change from a forested to a flattened to a secondary forest. And you will have then a different kind of ecosystem growing with different species to support it. But you may lose your iconic species of Malaysia.
On that note about iconic species, if you both had to give a report card for 2015 on the endangered species that you're working on to protect and conserve, what would that report card look like?
If you ask me, tapir is another issue that we need to look at seriously. You know, tapir is a logo of Malaysian Nature Society. You know, with lack of information on tapir breeding, roaming area, and so on, and the rapid development. Fragmented the forest and so on. So tapir is facing a problem now. And beside that, I think as what Sundari said, I agree, we don't have detailed studies, not only the species, but the habitat also. Like Belum Temenggo, we are talking about 10 species of hornbills there. But what are the studies that we are carrying out on the hornbills in the area? So this is something important to study. We need to bring more people to focus on this area for the future conservation of Belum Temenggo.
Yeah, I know tapir is an important, it's a logo of the Malaysian Nature Society. But I'll go on to the other species. For us, actually, in the report card, in order of rank, I'll give you reasons why we would say this. Number one would be the Sumatran rhino. Despite intensive survey efforts, there has been no signs of the wild Sumatran rhinoceros in Malaysia since 2007. Apart from two females that were captured and they are for breeding purposes in 2011 and 2014 respectively. So actually scientists consider it to be extinct in the wild in Malaysia. And we urge conservation efforts in Indonesia to pick up the pace. So maybe we have to now resort to artificial reproduction technology. You know, looking at sperms and ovum and doing the same kind of in vitro fertilization. The techniques are there. I think the Malaysian government or the Sabah government is working with a particular zoo in Germany and Cincinnati Zoo in the US. The second would be the Malayan tigers. There's an estimate of 250 to 340 individuals in Malaysia, and we thought there was 500, so the estimate has come down. Now, we should be very proud of the Malayan tiger. It's the national emblem. It's the emblem of the Malayan Bank. It's the emblem of Pasukan Harimau, which is our national football team. And there are only 13 countries in the world of 200 that has tigers, and Malaysia is one of the 13. We are losing this to poaching, rampant poaching. The third will be clouded leopard. We have clouded leopard in Borneo and Peninsula Malaysia, different species. And the estimates that we have done, because we only have funds for that particular area, in Belum Temenggo, the estimate is, scientifically, using the spatially explicit capture-recapture method, we have about 3.46 individuals per 1,000 square kilometres. For 100 square kilometres. 3.46 individuals in 100 square kilometres in Temenggo Forest. So there again, you see that there's an opportunity for us to do a full survey nationally, but you need more people trained in this, you need a lot of funds, and it is quite time-consuming. And the fourth one would be the Bornean elephants or pygmy elephants. The last record in 2010 suggests that we have about 2,000 pygmy elephants, but it is a range of 1,200 to 3,600. And lastly would be the orangutans. In Sabah alone, we have 11,000 orangutans. That is the 2,006 count. And probably in Sarawak, we would have 2,000 individuals. And we're still actually getting some of these numbers, you know, for the last 3-4 years. And these sensors take a long time. You can't do every year. It's not like going to your garden and counting the number of flowers or plants or birds that you have. It is very exhaustive. Probably, Prof, you'd like to say what Malaysian Nature Society, you know, think that. Do you agree with this list, Prof?
That is a common list that we always discuss.
Yeah.
What I mentioned about tapir and others is a future so that people are aware. We don't want to be like rhinoceros. It's very difficult to find now. Before we already discussed many years ago about rhino, before we lost our rhino in Sungai Dusun. So, but now it's continue and now we cannot even see the footprint. So we don't want to repeat this for tapir and others. And another thing that I want to highlight is a chemical pollution. So contaminated habitat, especially the coastline area where we have the shorebirds. And for example, the milky stock release program in Kuala Gula. So how far they are exposed to contaminated mudflat because of shipping activities, because of industrial activities, and inland agriculture activities where they use a lot of pesticide and fertilizer. So this kind of thing also we need to monitor and highlight. So the protected area, we need to make sure it's free from the heavy chemical contamination.
Moving on to highways, the Selangor State Government put a stop to the KidX Highway this year, but others seem to be moving forward towards construction, including the EKVE, which, for example, will cut through the Ampang Forest Reserve, affecting the sustainability and security of water supply in the state. It's also a cause of concern in terms of soil erosion and landslides and impact on wildlife. What are your thoughts on this?
Actually, we've been following closely the EKVE Highway. We have mobilised public support. We have explain what the EIA means, the report, and public consultations on our own. We've gone to see the Chief Minister and the parties concerned. So now I think, this goes to show that we have environmental guidelines and policies, consultations are taking place, but with a sweep of a pen, approvals are taking place without telling us why it's done. I think now the residents around that area are speaking and voicing up, and collectively they are calling the action for the government to actually stop this. So we're trying different means. We'll see. I think we're supporting the residents by giving them facts, you know, scientific facts. We don't want it to happen. Look at what Karak Highway just about 4 weeks ago. Because the top of the hill, there was some clearing, and it's very soft mud, and it's rainy season. And what do you have? Just mud. Because Malaysia, the soil we have is very loose. And we have a lot of rainfall. You would be hard-pressed to find a place which does not have less than 2,000 actually millimeters of rainfall per year. So, because of the monsoons. And therefore, we need to be very careful. Once you clear the land, maybe it should not be clear everything. You have to selectively clear, making sure there's still some ground cover. So little plants that cover the soil. Or quickly, you know, put some creepers. There are a lot of things that can be done, management regimes that must be enforced so that such landslides, mudflats, in fact, that's what we had in Cameron Highlands, devastation, you know. People's livelihoods are actually at stake. It's not just the people. Life is one thing, but livelihoods. And for the ecosystem to come back to its natural would take another few more years with a lot of money that we need to pump in. So in the first place, let's save what we have as nature. Keep it as natural, but you still can do what you want. Bearing in mind not to devastate the hill slopes and contour farming for horticulture and vegetable farming in Camerons.
Moving forward, one of the hugest stories this year, is COP21. It was recently concluded. It was a success in terms of the 195 countries agreeing to try to limit the rise in global temperatures to less than 2 degrees Celsius. Your thoughts on this agreement, Prof? Perhaps we'll start with you.
In general, we agree about the global warming and the function of our forests, right? So what is the key here is we need to protect our forests, especially those who are hilly parts and where we identify as a water catchment area. We cannot develop and we have to protect them, because this will affect the whole ecosystem nearby if we cut the forest. So we know already this one, what we need to do, we need to make our public aware and support what we, MNS and WWF and others, are doing to protect and conserve the environment and nature. So people are talking about climate change, about temperature rises, but what we are doing, we keep doing, develop our country, cutting forests, and then introduce unfriendly industries and so on. So, in general, we have to protect our green, our area, our catchment area.
I think it's the Paris Climate Deal has been lauded as historic, sweeping or ambitious. For the fact that 195, 196 countries, it's not a binding agreement, but they have agreed in principle to reduce the emissions so that the global warming in terms of the cap of 2%, at least 1.5%, you know, so less than the 2% warming in future, and convert to renewables and use less fossil fuels. Now, when it's binding, all these countries do it in good faith, because you wouldn't like to come to a conference of parties in 3 years down the line and say that you've not done this. Now, Malaysia had, and many countries had to submit intended nationally determined commitment to the Paris climate. I think about maybe 80 to 90 countries did that. And in this, in Malaysia, what they've said is we would, by 2030, we'll reduce 45%. Conditionally, 10%. That means 35% is what we will say we'll do. Unconditionally is because we need capacity building, funding, technology transfer. So they've actually charted a roadmap. In the year 2030, Malaysia would reduce its emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, by 45%. But 35% is definite. That's what we'll do. But the additional 10% will depend on transfer of technology and funding. Now, WWF did a kind of study on all the intended nationally determined commitment. They call it INDCs. And they found that developing countries have committed to do beyond their fair share. And when they analyze the developed country, they are actually doing less than what they should in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So, in fact, so this doesn't really augur very well for this balance between developed and developing countries.
When it comes to, developing, and all these different indexes that we look at, Malaysia was ranked poorly in terms of environmental democratic rights, coming in 69th of 70 countries surveyed worldwide. We got poor marks, for instance, in transparency and public engagement, with only a fair score where justice was concerned. Do you think that this is a fair ranking?
It's a ranking done by World Resource Institute. I think we've been poor in being transparent and sharing information. Freedom of information is important. Once the public and other agencies, private companies, NGOs, academia get this information, then we are able to use the information to make informed decisions. Now, what kind of information are we really looking at? Concession license holders, logging contractors, who are they, where they're operating, where's the boundary of your palm oil plantation, how's the deforestation rate if you have been monitoring it? Let us have it. And I don't think maps should be considered as official secrets, maps of this kind. It's for land use purposes, so we're able to tell the government this is how sustainable land use can be implemented, and which is a zone that you can do agriculture on, which is a zone you can have factories, and where you need to actually conserve as key watersheds so you do not have problems with your water. Even Sabah government is very liberal, but yet we find hard-pressed to find examples of where they have been freedom of information that's, you know. So I think government, with the help of all of us, can improve hugely on this, you know, democracy type of rule where information is available. We don't want just summaries which are very brief. For example, an auditor goes to a forest reserve and audits it and say it is certified. But the information that's given on the map is very low resolution. You really don't know if there's deforestation or it's just the whole area is a certified area. Selangor and Penang, in their local legislation, have incorporated Freedom of Information Act. And I think likewise other states could follow suit. Yeah.
Professor?
I think in terms of law, regulation, and freedom to speak, I think it's there in Malaysia. But the most important is you have to look at the implementation. If you look at the case in Johor, for example, on the Merambung area, and you talk about actively happening now in Kuantan, so the rules and regulations are already there, but how much the implementation of the rules and regulation, how much the enforcement, how far public and NGO strong enough to say something and make it happen. See, we promote every year, say something about your environment, tell your authority about the environment, tell your prime minister, for example, about the environment, what you want, but how far it happened. So I believe education is very important, and we need to do it very aggressive now.
Looking forward, what are the projects that both MNS and WWF Malaysia are working towards in 2016? Prof, we'll start with you.
Our focus is very simple, to protect the environment and to promote the conservation. So in order to do it, one of the major issues is we are doing education because we believe education at all levels, from school to primary school, secondary school, and to the executive level, we should tell them about what's happening in the environment. We work together with the government and the government agencies so that they will support us, and then we work together for that. Without education, I think public are not aware, and that's why we are weak to go against the project that disturb or destroy the environment. Like what happening in Chini Lakes, what happening in now in Kuantan, where the coastal area was disturbed and then affect the marine life, for example. So this kind of thing, without education, we cannot take proactive action to supervise or advise the government on the decision.
Dr. Sundri?
Just 2 years ago, we started a program called Market Transformation Initiative. We are looking at three commodities, palm oil, timber and seafood, where we're looking at the entire supply chain, value chain from the production. See, WWF is present in Sabah, Sarawak and Peninsula Malaysia in certain states. But we advocate how timber is produced sustainably, how palm oil is produced using the RSBO guidelines or best management practices. And it is labelled as it goes on, so the value chain. So consumers have a choice. And we're also talking to banks, financial institutions. They can actually 3 years ago, I think our Honourable Prime Minister says that financial institutions and listed companies should incorporate environment, sustainable governance, social governance indices in their way of preferential loaning and disbursement of funds. So they have criteria. So banks need to be seen, they have to be clean, where they're funding, what activities they're funding. And the tools are there, mechanisms are there, but it has to be enforced. And this is something very interesting. So you can look at any point you want to intervene. You want to talk to the retailers, you want to talk to the public consumers, you have a choice. Or you want to talk to the producers, the timber, the companies that Ilok and the timber companies. Secondly, I think innovation is important as we go on. Public is not going to just give us money to save elephants and orangutans and tigers, but we need to tell them, why do you need to save the elephants? So the first thing is actually save the forest. You get clean water, your animals are intact, there's enough prey for these huge iconic species, and make sure forest fires are actually mitigated to the large extent. It is something that not just government should be doing. I think it is something all parts of society. You and I are very important in this mix.
Everybody has to
do it. Yes, academia,
yeah.
Private. The private sector actually wants to invest. They know from the nature they're going to get pure water. Let's say you need water for your food and beverage industry. So they would rather keep the forest. So this is what you call the payment for ecosystem services. So there are some financial models that can be implemented, but it has to be top-down in some cases. But all of us need to get together and speak the same language and look after Malaysia's environment.
And on that note, my final question is, how can the public get involved and support both your organizations? Are donations tax deductible?
In the case of WWF Malaysia, it is tax deductible. Yes, it is indeed. And we have sometimes face-to-face where we actually go to the public and raise money. We also have appeal letters, and social media nowadays is a good platform for crowdsourcing.
Professor?
Yeah, MNF have many centers in Malaysia. We have 13 branches. We have members. So this every branch, every centers are very active now, promoting education and conservation. We identify the issue that local area and promote it and let the public know. So we want all publics from schools, private sector, and so on join us. So we are very happy so far. There are many companies that come forward and are helping us to do the education program and some conservation activities on the very localized area. So public is very important, so that this is the power of politics to change or to protect our environment.
Thank you both very much for coming in today. For more information, you can visit wwf.org.my and mns.my. I have been speaking with Dr. Sundari Ramakrishna, Conservation Director at WWF Malaysia, and over the phone is Professor Dr. Ahmad Ismail, Vice President of the Malaysian Nature Society and a wildlife and ecotoxicology expert. Together, we've been looking at the big environment stories of 2015. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.